The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30.
We're going to start the week trending a little bit earlier than we had intended. We have Aoife Barry, a journalist and author of Social Capital, with us, and Ian Power, Chief Executive of Spunout.ie. And I want to ask you both as to what you think of the story which has really emerged today in relation to Roger O'Gorman, the Equality Minister, having his home targeted in a very sinister fashion, given that it seems to have been hooded men who were putting posters on the railings and wall of his home, Aoife.
Yeah, it's really shocking. I saw some of the videos going around of it on Twitter today, and it showed not just one, you know, poster. They had written on a sheet, something on a sheet about him hating children that was put at the front. That was put at the front gateway. They also had different banners and placards hanging up around his home, all the same things that were, you know, I would imagine defamatory. And some of them had, you know, masks on. There was somebody.
How brave of them to do it while wearing masks?
How brave to do it while wearing masks, indeed. Around the corner from them, you could see there was two Garda cars that were there that were kind of, you know, blocking the road. I mean, we've seen protests before on politicians' homes. It's getting more of a kind of popular thing. Paul Murphy has had multiple protests outside his home, often while he's trying to bathe his newborn child at home, himself and his partner. Gino Kenny has spoken out about this sort of thing as well happening too. And I think, you know, the comments by Simon Harris today saying it was very chilling to see this is something that you're going to see repeated by a lot of people, because it is very chilling to see people not just kind of exercising their democratic right to protest, but actually, you know, doing intimidating things in front of politicians' homes.
Yeah, what do you make of it, Ian?
Yeah, I guess.
Sorry, Ian Powers with us as well. Yes, Ian?
I guess, like, and Simon Harris would know, because, I mean, he was the target of it during the pandemic as well. Yeah. COVID folks, they weren't masked and it wasn't as kind of intimidating and menacing as I think last night's was. And I saw the video late last night and I used some choice words on X, formerly Twitter, about it, because I think it's just horrific. And in particular as well, there's a homophobic element to it, particularly in terms of Minister O'Gorman as well. It's designed to intimidate, and I can understand, you know, a lot of people today criticising the Gardaí in terms of their response to it, standing what seemed to be kind of idly by next to what was happening. But at the same time, I guess we're not privy to kind of what their strategies are. I
can understand. That's something that Drew Harris, the commissioner, previously said, that he believed in a sort of a hands-off approach.
A graduated
to that.
Approach, yeah, is what he termed
it. But is that really appropriate?
As.
I mean, to just stand by and watch while intimidation of anybody, but particularly a government minister, is taking place?
I don't think so, personally. I think at this point it needs to be swift, it needs to be sharp, it needs to be consequences for this type of thing. We need to stamp it out quickly and nip it in the bud before we start to see this happening on a wider kind of level, because there's no wonder. I mean, I heard a report this morning about, you know, certain councillors around the country who are not running for re-election, and we know how many TDs aren't, and it's going to have a chilling effect on democracy if people who are good, you know, people who want to serve in politics, and this is what they're faced with. And also as well, it's not just the minister, it's his husband, it's his neighbours, it's everybody else who lives in that vicinity too. There's plenty of places to protest if you have an issue with a policy. Outside a politician's home is not the place.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, like, what is the line for the Gardaí to fully step in and remove those people? And yet at the same...
But sorry, isn't there a problem that if they do, there's suddenly there's videos where they get accused of being heavy-handed, and those who are in their masks because they're not brave enough to be seen to do what they're doing will end up crying that they're martyrs for their great cause?
The Gardaí are really caught in a bind here, and I think that's why we're seeing this sort of approach happening, not just here, but when you're talking about other types of protests, you're talking about seeing people do things that to the ordinary person looks very intimidating and looks like something the Gardaí should step in and say, this, you know, we're going to be, you know, this is a public order and, you know, issue, we're going to move you on. But like you said there, Matt, the issue is also, I mean, everything's being filmed, people are broadcasting things live. Do the Gardaí look like in those videos they're intimidating people, and where does that go from there?
But Aoife, it's also interesting because this is happening in real life as distinct from online. When you wrote the book about the type of behaviour that happens online. Now, sometimes it's what's filmed has been filmed for use online.
Totally.
But however intimidating and bad it may be to have these idiots going after you on social media, it's far worse when they actually start turning up in the street in front of you or outside your house, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's also, it is a kind of a relationship between the two things. So people aren't just turning up outside places, you know, in a silo, in a vacuum without it being connected to the internet. This is a lot of the time, you know, happening because people are meeting, are creating certain kind of attitudes and arguments and targeting people. I mean, if you look at the comments below, a lot of the videos of what happened, happened or people sharing the video. People are supporting it online, on Twitter, on X. They're saying it's a wonderful thing. They're finding a community who really agree with them. And you're finding that people are kind of gathering together who might not normally connect with each other and then are able to meet in person and actually do things like this. And it is really, I think, a very scary moment for people to see this the sort of behavior.
Listener says, these protesters are a disgrace, masked up like cards. You couldn't pay them to wear a mask during COVID.
There's a lot of hypocrisy going on with a lot of these things, indeed.
Absolutely. And I think the issue with this as well is obviously you don't want to make martyrs out of them, but at the same time, like, you don't want a replication of the situation with the librarians where they were being tortured by these people. Lots of, like, you know, the Venn diagram isn't fully a circle, but lots of these people are the same as who would have been targeting them as well. And really, I do think that the vast majority of decent people wouldn't have any objection to the Gardaí ripping them out of there.
Okay, we need to take a break. We come back and talk about all the other things in the week trending with Ian Power from spunout.ie and journalist Aoife Barry after this. Continuing the week trending with Aoife Barry, journalist and the chief executive of spunout.ie, Ian Power. Tell us, what did Simon Harris, our new Taoiseach, say that has caused a little bit of angst about Berlin and Belfast?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story that kind of emerged at the start of the week. So when I first saw it, I only saw the headline, and you could be forgiven for thinking that he said something very different to actually what he said. But he was speaking at the British-Irish Parliamentary Assembly in Wicklow on Monday morning, first thing. And he was saying that we really have to challenge ourselves to build interpersonal relationships on the island. He said, probably people of my generation are familiar now with London and Berlin and Paris, more familiar than they might be with Belfast or Derry. And he pointed out that he himself was too young to vote in the referendum on the Good Friday Agreement. And really, like, what he was saying ultimately is that we need to get to know each other a bit more. I think from my perspective, you know, it won't be the experience of all young people, especially those young people who live along the border counties. They cross the border every day to kind of go about their lives and their business. But, you know, myself, born and grew up in Waterford, like, it was such a long kind of, you know, practically journey to get to kind of Northern Ireland that we never really did it.
Yeah, it was 8-hour, 9-hour trip. So yeah, just geographically speaking, in the 90s and early 2000s, wasn't a place you were heading.
No.
A lot of people were heading on their holidays. Whereas now we're just talking, I was in Belfast last month, we were both in Derry the year before because we live geographically a lot nearer and love going up to those cities.
Yeah.
I think there is that geographical...
But you see, I think it goes back further, because I think Simon Harris, if he's talking about his generation and younger, it's actually the older generation, people of my age, because I used to go to Belfast a lot in the 1970s as a child because my mother was from Belfast, so we would go up to my grandmother. But of all of the people I grew up with, I was the only person who'd ever set foot north of the border going up from Cork. Mm-hmm. It was just completely alien, and the whole idea was it's not safe because of what was going on, and that carried into the 80s. And I've come across people from the south who have never been north of the border.
Yeah, definitely. I think the first time I went to Belfast was in my probably like early, maybe late 20s, early 30s. I was in Tyrone because my aunt is from Tyrone. We were up there for a wedding in the late 90s, I think. In an ideal world, sure, we would love to that every single county was treated the same on the island. But because, unfortunately, of the history, there are, unfortunately, attitudes about certain parts of the country. There can also be attitudes about certain parts of the country for other reasons. But I think, we can't deny that there are going to be those attitudes there, and that it actually is good to say to people, we should be going wherever we want on the island of Ireland. And it is good to create relationships where people travel to different parts where they haven't been, or where they might have totally wrong preconceptions because of their own history and their own past.
Yeah, I thought that piece in the Irish Times as well, Newton Emerson, I thought it was really interesting where it was pointed out that kind of essentially, you know, if you are... the more that you actually cross the border, the more likely you are to support a united Ireland.
Yeah.
So, and that's ultimately what the Taoiseach was saying. So it's really interesting that Sinn Féin jumped in it and started to make it out like, you know, he was saying something completely different when, you know, they're obviously very much in favour of united Ireland. So it was, like, some of that data was really interesting in terms of how likely people were to support that based on their interaction. So, I mean, ultimately, I think it makes sense that if we want to see it in our lifetimes, we probably do need to spend some time getting to know each other a bit better.
Yeah. You'd be a lot more worried if he was saying, like, if he was treating, you know, parts of the island like as if they were places that were no-go areas, or there was some strange thing about people living there, or, you know, in the sense that would just keep the idea of partition and the idea of people being different in the ether. So it's much more welcome maybe to make a slightly flat-footed comment than say the opposite.
Okay, let's move on to the TV licence inspectors requiring resilience training, Ian. Why is this?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one as well from this week, where there's been a backlash, understandably. You can imagine why it's happening after the RTE scandal last summer. But apparently Unpost was forced to stop TV licence inspections and offer resilience training to staff because of public anger over the RTE payment scandal. A spokesperson said that increased hostility, mainly in the form of verbal abuse, led Unpost to taking action to protect its workers. And like, for me, it's really interesting. Like, you know, nobody should have to withstand any sort of hostility as you're going about your day job or your work. I kind of object to it. Workers being trained to be resilient, because that's almost then assuming that, or taking the point that you should, you're expecting this type of behaviour.
That you actually, bad manners and bad behaviour by the people that you go to making a legitimate inquiry, that you're at fault if you actually get upset by their bad manners.
Yeah, instead of kind of focusing actually on the perpetrators of the abuse and saying actually there might be consequences and maybe fines should be higher for non-compliance with the licence fee if you're abusive towards the inspector. I could understand de-escalation training or kind of conflict resolution training, personal safety training, but the resilience piece, that really annoyed me.
What do you think?
I think it's unsurprising that the inspectors are coming across some sort of, behaviour on the doorsteps, because when you think about it, it's very hard for somebody to actually comment to the people who are actually involved in the RTE scandal, right? So it's, you can write a letter or whatever, but their next way of communicating with people is to find the next person that has a contact with that. And I think people were using not paying the TV licence as a means of protest for a certain period of time. Now, according to the figures, the fines have actually lessened overall, I think, since the kind of they grew and then they dropped again. So people are maybe not protesting so much as they were, but it's a way of protest for people. They saw the scandal that was happening. I heard a lot of people, peers telling me they weren't going to pay their TV licence because of it.
And did they afterwards, do you think, or was it all talk?
I think for some, we definitely see in the figures, there was fines totalling over 18 grand in January 2022. 38 grand was how much the, over 38,000 was how much that figure had increased to in January last year, but then it's dropped to 22 grand. So some people definitely did decide not to pay, and then others decided they would. I don't think anybody wants to get a fine or appear in court either, so that probably was a threat for some people not to.
Okay, let's move on. The footwear and sportswear apparel company Nike, its chief executive is blaming work from home for a slowdown in product innovation. What do you make of that, Ian?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one as well. So this was head of Nike was on CNBC being interviewed about kind of just maybe the lackluster kind of product line, I guess, that Nike is producing for those that love to buy new sneakers and new runners. He pointed out that footwear factories in Vietnam were forced to shutter during the COVID-19 pandemic, but he said even more importantly, Nike's employees worked from home for 2.5 years, and apparently in hindsight, it turns out it's really hard to do bold, disruptive innovation to develop a boldly disruptive shoe on Zoom, he said. So, I mean, like, for me, I think it's a really boring and lazy excuse. Like, everybody kind of knows and understands that work from home was something we had to adapt to. It's not necessarily conducive to innovation, but like, you have to work harder, you have to be smarter, you have to think of ways and create new spaces for creativity. Like, for me,
why not just go back to what worked previously?
Because I think that workers aren't going to go for that. So if you're a company who wants the best talent, you have to be competitive in terms of what you're offering. And people have seen the benefits of working from home in terms of the work-life balance. And so if you're not offering some level of kind of work from home, then you're going to be at a complete disadvantage to kind of get the right people. I think for me, this is more of a legacy business with kind of legacy thinking, really, from my perspective. I think that a lot of these big companies now are, outsourcing to smaller firms that are actually a bit more snappy and scrappy and are doing things that are way more interesting. You just have to look at Yeezy, for example, with Adidas. Internally, they were kind of scrambling, so they just bring somebody on as a creative kind of... I'm sure Kanye didn't do a huge amount of the work now, to be honest. That's kind of the way that it's moving anyway. It's not like, we're expecting them to be kind of complete bastions of innovation themselves.
Yeah, but let's come back to this issue of work from home, because there is a sort of a move against it. Now, maybe it's a lot of employers want to get better value out of the office space that they actually have.
Yeah, definitely.
But at the same time, is there not an awful lot to be said for the face-to-face interaction that takes place when people are working together that doesn't happen when you're on Zoom calls or phone calls?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things going on there, because you do have the return to work mandates that big companies like Amazon and Google had brought in, where they want employees to be in the office for usually minimum 3 days a week, and they have to be in there, to the point where I think Amazon was going to be kind of really measuring how people were behaving around that. And that is because those companies were saying exactly what you're saying there. They're saying, if we want actually people to work well together, we want to have more face time in the office, it's easier to manage people, it's easier to just bump into your colleague, it's easier to collaborate. And I think anybody who has worked fully from home after COVID or done a day or two in will know there is a difference when you're in the office to when you're at home, in terms of you do bump into your colleague, you do have the face-to-face meetings. But things have changed, like the workplace has changed radically since the COVID pandemic began. And people now want more flexibility. A lot of people, a lot of parents, people with caring responsibilities, people, you know, with disabilities, neurodiversity, all sorts of other reasons, people realise that flexibility actually really does benefit them, and it doesn't make them bad workers. So yeah. I do think that companies, you know, and kind of like what Ian was saying there, smaller companies in particular are actually selling themselves on the viewpoint of, we actually, you can work anywhere in the world, you can do a hybrid role or you can do a work from home role. Yeah. And we won't be seeing that with the bigger companies, because they have too much money at stake. They have too much to lose. Billions to lose, maybe, compared to
that. And anybody I talk to who works at the big tech companies resent the hell out of having to go into the office 3 days a week. So I can imagine that productivity yeah. isn't great, and culture isn't great when you're forcing people to do something that they could probably do from home. And for, in our, you know, kind of example in terms of Spunout, like, we have fantastic talent in Donegal and other places, you know, that we wouldn't be able to have on the team if we didn't have kind of work from home available. And our teams come together, each team comes together for 2 days a month to do that type of work that you need to kind of do in person, that brainstorming, the creativity piece, and then most of the other stuff you can do by yourself at your desk from wherever you're living.
Doesn't that become very lonely for everyone if they're home? Should you not have a demarcation between your workplace and your home life?
I think that a lot of people are more into the hybrid at the moment. I can't even remember the figures, but I know I was doing some reading on this, and particularly too with the US and different polls, and there's a lot of people in favour of the hybrid model above any other model, where you kind of have the best of both worlds. You have your at home time where it's easier for you to have that work-life balance, and then you do get to go into the office and meet people, and you get to have that collaboration. I mean, I work from home all the time as a freelancer, but I love going out to meet people. But I do feel very productive when I'm sitting at the desk, and I haven't worked full time in an office since before COVID. And do I miss being in an office 5 days a week? I mean, it's just kind of a better way to live, in a way, being hybrid.
Okay, tell us, Ian, about the mass tourism backlash in, of all countries, Spain,
yeah,
which I think has built its economy in recent decades on tourism.
100%, and the epicentre of this is an interesting spot as well, in that it's the Canary Islands. And I was actually there last week, and I came across some of this, and I was really interested by it, because actually the reason
what did you come across?
So what I spotted, so there's this kind of mass tourism backlash, and essentially there is kind of communities and activists who are rebelling against how much development is happening in, you know, and spoiling kind of different parts of their country in favour of the tourism, you know, kind of tourism economy, essentially. But what I had spotted was there was a number of different campaigns where, you know, there was different posters, different kind of billboards, and I kind of followed it up on Instagram, where basically people were objecting actually mostly to things like hydroelectric power plants, you know, wind turbines and solar farms and things like that, which I'm assuming are being put in place to deal with the energy demands that maybe tourism is placing on the islands themselves as well. But in particular, in this case, you know, there's a big campaign after sprouting up in Tenerife in particular, campaigning against the development of two new hotels on the island. And ultimately, activists and campaigners are saying that, look, you know, it's not sustainable for us to continue growing the tourism industry to a point where, I think, was there something like 16 million visitors to the Canaries last year, whereas there's actually only 2.2 million inhabitants of all of the islands combined. So,
and if they don't get all these tourists, where's their revenue going to come from?
Absolutely.
Because these are pretty barren islands.
Well, do you know, the one thing I was, you know, we kind of moved from Las Palomas for the weekend, and then up to Las Palmas for the kind of the middle of the week. And actually, there's a huge amount of industry on the island itself. There's a huge amount of service industry on the island.
Service industry for the tourists?
No, professional services, I meant, but also service. Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of tourism, and they do rely on it. There's no doubt about that. But like, I think a balance needs to be struck.
Yeah, I think it's that is a thing of balance. Where I mean, I remember going to Barcelona like 10 or more years ago, and there'd be signs on, you know, different apartments saying, you know, no to Airbnb. There's like long been a backlash against, you know, promoting places for tourists to stay above locals in some Spanish countries. And you can understand when the balance tips over, where people feel that, okay, there's more of an emphasis on drawing more and more and more people in and building more things and bringing more people, tourists in for the season, and not enough investment in local places, that people are going to be upset about that, you know. And I think, like, if the government policy is not to invest also in local businesses that are there at the same time, and there isn't that balance, then people are going to feel annoyed.
And I think the Airbnb point is a really important one as well, because, you know, you can see that in Dublin. We have an accommodation crisis, yet there's all these short-term let rooms online that people could be living in, and actually, you know, providing accommodation for people. And it's similar, in fact, to the story that we saw in Dingle, like, I think it was late last year, where, like, they were talking about how the fact that, you know, it's going to be really hard because essentially all of the accommodation in Dingle is for tourists. And so where are the next generation supposed to live and put down roots and make it a productive place that will be still there for tourists?
Okay, a couple of things just to finish off quickly. But tell us about the British moves to make smoking more difficult for people.
Yeah, they basically want to do something very, very serious, which New Zealand tried to actually do, and to ban people who were born, I'm just going to check the year, after 2009, ban people born after 2009 from buying cigarettes. So basically, anybody who's born from that year on, you know, sorry lads, you won't be able to buy a pack of cigarettes in a UK shop. Now, like I said, this is something that they did try to bring in New Zealand. It was brought forward and then it was later repealed. This is called the Tobacco and Vapes Bill, and it was passed by 383 votes to 67. So there's a lot of support for it, championed by Rishi Sunak. You know, it's an attempt, really, I suppose, to try and prevent more of a, you know, a burden on the NHS in terms of, you know, health and how smoking affects people with their long-term kind of, you know, health implications and things like that. But then there's also the question of, well, like, you know, if somebody wants to smoke, should they just not be, you know, allowed to smoke and maybe just slap a big tax on cigarettes?
Does it include vaping?
It does include vaping, and you know, particularly,
that's what younger people are going for rather than smoking.
Absolutely.
We flavored vapes. I mean, that is where you are should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Charging.
And we see a huge amount of that. You know, we just ran a vaping harm reduction campaign and spun out there the last couple of weeks. I mean, to me, yes, you know, there's the liberty argument that you should be able to personally do this, but actually, the strain on the health system is such that, in the UK, for example, in this story, 80,000 deaths a year caused by tobacco use, and there's a patient admitted to hospital every minute in England as a result of it. So for me, you know, I do think there's a wider societal case for doing something like this. I think we need to crack down both on tobacco use and vaping. I think we need to be stronger in our legislation here. And in terms of the UK one, the one thing I thought was that the £100 fine to shops selling vapes, that's not really a deterrent in the money they're making off them.
One final one. The Royal Jam Wars?
Yeah, this is really interesting because Meghan Markle basically has started this new company called American Orchard Riviera, which really just rolls off the tongue. she sent around a kind of a jam jar or a jar of jam to influencers in an attempt to raise awareness about her new venture, and everybody's kind of trying to figure out what's going on with it. But apparently, according to a royal commentator, so I'm going to put a huge health warning on this because I actually don't know like how much of this is actually the case. No offence to Richard Eden, who was speaking to the Royal Mail. He's actually their royal commentator. He is trying to claim that this publicity stunt, or, you know, what's known as just publicity offering, was beneficial for King Charles, because King Charles actually sells a range of preserves and savouries from his shop called Highgrove Shop. I'm sure he's not behind the counter. They're just there. And apparently, his Highgrove Organic Strawberry Preserve, which is priced at £6.95, sold out on Tuesday, mere hours after Meghan launched her product on Monday. Therefore, people assuming that she got, you know, wanted people to pick up some sort of strawberry jam, and they decided to protest against her and go in and buy the
King's. That's the most contrived story.
So, like I said, huge health warning, whether or not you believe the details of that. But it will be interesting to see what American Riviera Orchard, I can't say those words together, what it will do for her, because it's an interesting move for her. It's a bit more of a, like, a domestic move for her towards, you know, she's got a cooking show coming out. And as someone who you might have seen trying to enter politics at some stage, it's really interesting.
She's trying to be Gwyneth Paltrow.
Well, yes, because Goop is one of the biggest brands in the entire universe. And, you know, I think if you want to do anything and be a kind of woman in business in America, a celebrity, then you would want to be following Gwyneth's footsteps.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Aoife Barry and Ian Parr, for being with us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.